Thank you.
Sure.
To the police and court, my name is Lynn Lyon, registration number 12390. I represent United Airlines, the appellant in this case. They are the respondent employer in the workers' compensation case, and I'll refer to them as the respondent. The issue we have here is a new issue that needs to be determined. We are claiming that there is an overpayment to the extent TTD benefits were paid in excess of the statutory cap that has been imposed under Section 842.107.5. That section limits combined TTD and PPD benefits, the so-called indemnity benefits in the workers' compensation case, based upon the determination of the permanent impairment rating. That impairment rating is not determined until the end of the case, when the claimant or injured worker reaches maximum medical improvement. In this particular case, when the claimant reached maximum medical improvement, it was determined she had a 5% impairment rating. And Section 842.107.5 states that no claimant whose rating is 25% or less shall receive more than $75,000 in combined temporary disability and permanent partial disability. In this case, by the time the impairment rating was determined, Ms. Jones had already received more than $99,000 in TTD benefits. So when the final admission was filed by United Airlines, an overpayment was asserted. The cap of $75,000 was asserted, and an overpayment of roughly $24,000 was claimed. This went to hearing. The judge determined that there was no overpayment because the benefits that claimant received during the period of temporary disability, she was entitled to receive those.
Do you quarrel with that?
No, not at that time. I do not.
Well, I don't mean at the record, but you accept that under 842.105.3, she's entitled to benefits even if they run over the cap up until she's released from work or deemed to be an MMI.
That's correct.
Okay.
There's no mechanism by which we can terminate benefits regardless of the cap, because we can't determine which cap applies or if any cap will apply until we reach MMI. In some cases of permanent total disability, TTD benefits continue, but they're renamed to permanent total disability. So we can't determine which cap is going to apply, so it's unknown whether there's an overpayment. Potentially there's an overpayment, but we just don't know. We can't terminate the benefits.
Counsel, the same way that the employer can't terminate benefits until you have an employee that's been released to return to work or has reached MMI, how is the employee supposed to know then when he or she should stop receiving benefits? How is Ms. Jones supposed to know that, okay, I've gotten 75, I can't get any more benefits because then I'm going to owe? So, if it's not fair to the employer to guess when that MMI number or release to work date is, why is it fair to hold her to that burden?
Well, I don't know that we can use the term fair in the context of workers' compensation, because the statute isn't necessarily fair. You don't get your full replacement. You don't get pain and suffering. Let's just use the example of a claimant who is off work and receives an award for Social Security disability benefits. Those full TTD benefits were due at the time they were paid, but once you receive the Social Security disability, benefits are retroactive, so it creates an overpayment retroactively, and so then that claimant is required to repay that overpayment.
But the definition of overpayment doesn't specifically contemplate a retroactive analysis.
Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think that the statute that defines overpayment, 842.01.15.5, contemplates that an overpayment may come into existence after the benefits have been properly paid.
What specific language are you referring to, please?
I'm referring to the in 842.01, subparagraph 15.5, says, first of all, that overpayment is defined as money that's received by a claimant that exceeds the amount that should have been paid.
Okay, let's stop there.
Okay.
If you read that in the context of 105.3, she only got money that should have been paid because she wasn't at MMI, right?
It should have been paid at the time.
Okay.
But when we get to the next part of that same definition of overpayment, it says, for an overpayment to result, it is not necessary that that overpayment exist at the time the claimant received the disability benefits. So I believe that that allows for a retroactive determination that there can be an overpayment.
Are there any cases that have interpreted that last sentence one way or the other?
Well, there's two cases that have talked about it to, not specifically in this case, but let's take a look at Donald B. Murphy Contractors versus ICAO 916 Pacific 2nd 611. In that case, the respondents filed a final admission asserting the cap, and some permanent partial disability was paid. The claim was reopened, and TTD was reinstated. But the court said that the respondent would take a credit against that award of TTD for the PPD that had been paid up to the cap. So now the claimant is entitled to TTD but is receiving no benefits until that permanent partial disability, let's just say it's $20,000, is used up. So we're saying $20,000 you're going to go on TTD without any benefits. And what the court said about allowing that credit is that allowing the credit would eliminate the need for further proceedings to seek recovery of an overpayment in the event no further benefits were available. Meaning that if the cap of $60,000 stayed, in that case it was a $60,000 cap, but if the impairment rating didn't exceed 25%, there would be no further benefits available. There's a second case that I think even touches on it more closely. It's Rogan versus ICAO 91P3rd 414 Colorado Appellate 2003. In that case, again, the respondent saw the final admission, asserted the cap, paid the PPD benefits up to the cap. Then the division IME was done at the request of the claimant, and the date of MMI was changed. It was actually made 2 years later than the first date, which is when the initial termination of TTD took place. At 1 year after that original MMI date, the claimant actually returned to work. So there was a period of time where that claimant could have received TTD for another year. And he was in that courtroom saying, I would like to have this TTD. If my MMI date had been determined before all of this transpired, then I would have received those benefits. You can't tell exactly from this case that it would have gone over $60,000, but the court talks about there's no basis to exempt the claimant from the cap. They denied that claim for TTD benefits, saying the possibility that he may have been able to obtain an overpayment if events had unfolded differently does not establish a right to such overpayment when his final, and they said MMI, but I think they meant impairment rating, is less than 25%. So to me, that's contemplating that there could be an overpayment depending on what the applicable cap is, and the benefits, the TTD benefits, which they denied to this claimant, exceeded the cap, $60,000. So they refused to give the claimant the TTD benefits. So I believe that panel of that division of the court recognized that the cap should apply. The cap should apply. And the cap section itself states, no claimant whose impairment rating is 25% or less should may receive more than $75,000. Okay, so why in this case would a claimant be exempted from that statute? There's not a basis for exempting them when this statute, this statute actually comes into effect after the termination of TTD statute. This is a newer statute, and I apologize, I don't know the effective date. But so why then is there a claimant who has a shorter period of time of disability, a 2 year period of disability, with a 25% impairment rating limited to $75,000? That person may not be able to go back to work, may have very serious injuries, may have multi-level lumbar fusion. I don't know, this case was a foot injury with a 5% impairment rating, full duty work release after 4 years on TTD. So that goes to why we're saying that as decided by the panel, it really is not it's not equal protection, because the claimants in those two situations are being treated differently based upon whether they receive TTD only or they receive a combination of TTD and PPD.
How do you have standing to raise an equal protection argument if the disparity falls on two different classes of claimants?
Well, I believe they're the same class of claimant, because these are all claimants who have an impairment rating who is 25% or less.
Okay, but you're making an equal protection argument that would seem to have an adverse impact, if any, on claimants. You're the employer. So how do you have standing to question a disparate treatment of claimants.
Well, what I'm arguing is that we should, that it should, they should be treated fairly. That's what the point of my argument is that all the claimants that have a rating of 25% or less should be treated fairly.
No, I think your argument is they should be treated equally, because we...
That's right. My own line used against me.
I'll come back to my question. I mean, how do you as an employer have standing to raise potential disparate treatment of claimants?
I can't answer that.
Okay. Go ahead.
I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Good morning, Your Honor.
We're running the podium down more.
That's probably a good idea. Good morning, Your Honor. Judge Webb, may it please the court. My name is Elsa Martinez Tenredo. My registration number is 1930380. And I represent Angela Jones in this matter, which is a workers' compensation case. First of all, I'd like to apologize for there are two mistakes in my brief that I did not notice until later after it had been submitted, and that was once I printed up the brief, I did not review the table of contents, pagination, and somehow when it got printed, it got off. I also want to apologize for the use of the word respondents in my brief. It should have been, I meant appellant, not respondent. And the workers' compensation system, we're so accustomed to using the word respondents. There's also something that I'd like you to be aware of that was not in my brief, and those are facts that I believe are pertinent to this particular argument. And those are facts which are contained in the appellate file at pages 352 through 359. And they're very particular facts. First of all, that when claimant was injured, when Ms. Jones was injured, she was working 40 hours a week. When she returned to work following her release at maximum medical improvement in July of 2011, she only returned to a 16-hour guarantee time per week. Now, during the time period that she was, before she had reached maximum medical improvement, she also had to file for bankruptcy because, as you know, when claimants receive temporary total disability benefits, it's only 2/3 of their wages. So she was in financial distress at that time. So she did file for bankruptcy, and I think that that's a pertinent fact in this particular case.
How is it pertinent if we're just interpreting the statute? I mean, the impact may have been, the impact of having to repay the money may be more egregious to her than it might be to somebody else, but how can we interpret the statute differently on that basis?
Well, the reason I think that those facts are pertinent, including the fact that she her home was foreclosed, is that I believe that the General Assembly, when they established both 842.105 subsection 3 and 142.107.5, they had this kind of situation in mind when they established it. 842.105 subsection 3 establishes how temporary total disability benefits should be paid. And the legislature was very clear that the claimant is entitled to those benefits until she reaches an MI or returns to work or is released to work and doesn't, or is offered work within modified duty and does not accept the work. So they were clear that there'd be a period of time when claimant receives temporary total disability benefits.
Well, and I think United Airlines concedes that. The question is, why shouldn't she have to pay it back now that she's got the MMI certificate, now that she's got the MMI determination that triggers the $75,000 cap?
Okay.
I believe that when looking at this case, we absolutely have to look at the General Assembly's intent in establishing both of these statutes separately. The section with regard to the cap is specifically stated not in 842.105, which is the temporary total disability benefits. It's established in the section that addresses permanency and permanent partial and medical impairment benefits, which is 842.107 and its subsection within, which all address either medical impairment benefits and benefits after maximum medical improvement. So when looking at both statutes in conjunction with each other, we're looking at 842.107 that addresses permanency, and the legislature established that cap because they wanted to reduce or limit or cap the benefits with regard to permanency, not necessarily temporary total. If the legislature really intended to have clients such as Ms. Jones, who following maximum medical improvement went beyond the cap tens of thousands of dollars, $24,000 plus money, to return that money that she received while she was disabled, they would have said so in the statute, and they would have put a cap in the temporary total disability benefit statute. So I think that there was a specific intent by the legislature when they established the cap provision under the permanent partial disability benefits section. And I understand case law is very clear that titles do not control when we're looking at statutes. But every part within each of the sections of 842.107 address permanency, and that's where that cap is. So I think that when the legislature established that cap and the subsequent courts determined that respondents had a credit for benefits that were paid beyond the cap, such as in the case that was previously addressed by counsel, like the Rogan case, where the claimant was placed at maximum medical improvement, went to a division IME, the division IME said not at MMI, and the claimant wanted benefits. Well, the claimant actually received the benefits. It's not that the claimant was overpaid, it's that the claimant received benefits following the date that was originally determined to be at MMI, and therefore the benefits that the claimant should have received in Rogan, the claimant received. They were called something different, they were called permanent partial disability benefits, but the claimant received those benefits, the temporary total disability benefits. The money was given to the claimant. In this particular case, in Ms. Jones's case, claimant was never given money which went beyond what was she was entitled to under 842.105, the temporary total disability statute. She never received permanent impairment, even though she had a permanent impairment.
So is it your interpretation of 107.5? That the $75,000 cap only applies or only comes into effect if a claimant receives both TDY and permanent partial?
Your Honor, I think that the cap applies only to permanent impairment. If the claimant was paid up to the cap, like in this case, let's say that she had only received $75,000. Now the statute has changed, and it changes every year what the cap is. But at the time, it would have been $75,000 for this particular date of injury. If the claimant had only received temporary total disability benefits up to that cap, she was not entitled to permanent partial disability benefits. I believe the statute, the way it reads, had she received $75,000 and no permanency, she would still have been entitled, had her case been reopened, such as in the, not the Rogan case, but the other case that...
Murphy.
The Murphy case, thank you, Judge. if the claimant had to reopen her case, she would still be entitled to temporary total disability benefits. So beyond the cap, because the cap couldn't apply if claimant is not at maximum medical improvement. And if her case was reopened, it's assumed that she's not at maximum medical improvement. So she would be entitled to benefits of permanency, which is beyond the cap. If she had received permanent impairment, then respondents would be entitled to a credit for the benefits that they paid in permanency up through the time that permanency was exhausted to pay for that permanent or temporary total disability benefits, which were already paid.
Okay, so let me ask if I'm understanding this correctly. Are you looking at 842.107.5 in the definition of no claimant of the 25% cap?
Yes.
Okay, so it says no claimant whose impairment rating is 25% or less may receive more than $75,000 from combined temporary disability payments and permanent partial. So you're saying there has to be both in order to activate
that? That's correct, Your Honor. So
in other words, if let's assume that your client got the $95,000, she's released to return to work, and she gets no permanent rating at all. Are you saying that the cap in 107.5 doesn't even apply to such a case?
No, it does apply, because claimant cannot receive any permanent impairment.
Well, no, that was built into my question.
Oh, I apologize.
Let's assume your client gets the $95,000. She's then released to return to work, and the dime examiner says you have no prospective impairment at all. You're 100% cured. Are you saying that the 107.5 cap just doesn't even apply because permanent benefits weren't part of the equation?
That's correct.
And you base that primarily on the location of 107.5 and its title?
Well, not just the location, but the reading both, interpreting both statutes in conjunction one with the other. The intent of the legislature is beneficent to claimants. The legislature determined the Workers' Compensation Act to work in order to provide benefits to claimant at a reasonable cost to employers. Well, that cost to employers is providing benefits which are reduced than wage replacement, benefits which are reduced by the fee schedule in terms of medical care. That's the benefit to the employer. The benefit to the claimant is that the claimant have benefits which are quick and efficiently delivered to her. In this particular case, part of those facts that I asked that you address as well is that this claimant, one of the ideals of the statute is that there shouldn't be any litigation. This claimant, after almost 2 years of care, she testified, and I think it was at 352, that she had to hire a lawyer to obtain quick benefits after 2 years of getting benefits. Because her benefits were not being provided, they were being denied and delayed and not being approved. So that's one of the precepts of the statute is that the, and I believe that this is in...
I'm sorry, but you lost me. But what does that have to do with interpreting the cap?
Because I think that statutory construction needs to be, the rules about statutory construction needs to be addressed. And for us to make sense of both of these statutes together, that liberal construction, beneficent purpose of the statute needs to be applied.
It seems to me what you're suggesting is that if the word combined means what you say it does, then we've got a bright line in the sand, there can be no litigation. Because if you only get temporary benefits, if it goes over the cap, it doesn't matter. And you only need to do a cap equation if there's permanent benefits.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there'd be nothing to leave.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And I think that the AFL-CIO versus Donnelly case addressed that when they addressed the issue of the cap. They specifically stated that the statute needs to be, that the legislature's intent needs to be addressed. When they establish what the statute is, clearly the state has an interest in protecting the state efficiencies. And the state efficiencies is part of how benefits are provided. And it would be, how do I say it? In this particular case, it would be atrocious to have a claimant have to pay back benefits that she never received. She didn't get any permanency. In this particular case, she wasn't getting any wages during the time she was getting temporary disability. For example, one of the cases that opposing counsel brought up is the case where the claimant gets Social Security benefits. Well, the claimant received additional benefits. Out of those additional benefits, they should be paying back appellant or respondents or the employer in this case. That's not what happened here. In this case, claimant did not get any additional benefits after she reached maximum medical improvement or was released, in this particular case, when she was released to return to work. The legislature could not have intended for the claimant to be indentured, literally in indentured servitude, to pay off $24,000 that she was originally entitled to and pay back to her employer, you know, for probably a year to pay that back without getting any compensation. The claimant, when she returned to work, returned to only 16 hours per week.
Why does that matter?
Because in looking at a whole, at the statute, in interpreting the statute as a whole, the legislature, when they determined that temporary disability benefits could not be terminated unless claimant reached maximum medical improvement, then it's important because why would they assign a benefit if they were going to later require a claimant to return it?
Okay, thank you. I think your time is exhausted.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would first like to point out in this case there is a situation where the claimant may have had an overpayment retroactive. Let's look at what would happen if she had requested a division IME, or even if United had requested a division IME, and the date of maximum medical improvement was placed back at a point in time, like say a year earlier than the date that was given. Temporary disability benefits end at the date of MMI, and so anything that was paid after the date of MMI would have been an overpayment. So I believe that that
but,
is...
I mean, that didn't happen.
No, but it could happen. What we're saying...
Are there any cases that have involved that scenario?
Well, there are cases where the...
you've reported opinions of this court?
I don't know, Your Honor. I didn't research that particular issue, but that's an example of how there can be an overpayment of TTD based upon a determination of MMI. It's clear that TTD benefits end on the date of MMI. The rules in the statute actually indicate that you can't file your final admission after MMI until there has been a determination of the impairment rating. There have been cases where that's happened a month after, and the rules indicate that anything paid after the date of MMI is accredited against the permanent partial disability.
What about your opponent's interpretation of 107.5 emphasizing the word combined, that the statute, that the cap doesn't even apply until permanent benefits become payable?
Well, claimant does have an award for permanent partial disability. She has an impairment rating of 5%.
Okay, but
it's only because of the cap that those benefits are paid.
Okay, doesn't that provide a reason to interpret the statute as your opponent says? In other words, the cap becomes effective only when an award of permanent benefits has been made. And if the cap's already exhausted, you get no permanent benefits. If the cap hasn't been exhausted, you collect permanent benefits only up to the point of the cap. So in other words, her interpretation, it seems to me, helps explain a problem with this case, which is does the cap work only prospectively or retrospectively? And if you use the word combined restrictively, as your opponent suggests, that provides a reason, or that provides a method for working it prospectively and never having to worry about a retrospective application.
I think that had it been intended to only apply to the permanent disability benefits, it could have been stated in that
section.
No,
it only applies when there are both.
Right, but in this case, what we're forgetting is that there is permanent partial disability. That has to be determined before we ever determine what that cap is going to be.
And once it's determined, if the cap's exhausted, then the employer has no liability, correct?
Right, but there is permanent impairment. So there's permanent impairment, it's just that those benefits have not been paid.
And would never be paid if the cap's been exhausted.
But it would never be paid, but if the case was reopened, then there would be, you know, potential for more permanent disability up to the cap again.
No, my point is if the cap's already been exhausted and permanent disability is determined but at less than 25%, the employer is not going to pay any more benefits, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And doesn't that solve the tension between these statutes of prospective, retrospective application of the cap?
I don't believe that it does, because you have to look at what the benefits are payable, and then you assert the cap after you determine what the benefits are that are payable. So there is a determination of permanent impairment. The only situation where there would be no permanent impairment is when the rating is zero. So if there is permanent impairment, those benefits have to be considered, and then you apply the cap.
Well, Ms. Lyon, there may be permanent impairment, but was the money received permanent benefits received?
No, there wouldn't be any benefits received. But if we look at the Rogan case, they talk about the fact that they're not going to award those temporary total disability benefits because that would create an overpayment. The Donald B. Murphy case talks about having to have further proceedings to recover the overpayment. And in Rogan, it says, the court says, the cap was designed to create an overall savings in the workers' compensation cost to employers, while allowing a more generous award to levels of impairment exceeding 25%. And the matter of how an overpayment is going to be recovered is within the judge's discretion. The statute allows the judge to hold a hearing and take evidence on that and make an order for recovery of overpayment, so that there's evidence taken and they can fashion an award that there might be a gradual period of recovery.
But there's no per se hardship exception.
No, there's not.
So your view is that there's an absolute right.
Yes, and the reopening statute, as it was amended in 1997, does allow recovery of overpayment as to monies already paid. There's only two situations where you can have that with monies already paid, and that's in cases of fraud and overpayment. So the legislature has looked at the fact that this money was already paid to the claimant and says you can recover it.
I think your time is exhausted. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.